$400 billion in student loan relief. My sense is the Biden administration wants to just get caught trying.
It reminds me of growing up and we'd have a student body election every year and they would be saying, oh, we're going to get a vending machine and we're going to put it in all the hallways. And every single presidential candidate would promise the vending machine, knowing that that is not a thing that could ever happen. I feel like it felt like a false promise to me, where this could actually be a really powerful area for reform.
Welcome to The Lost Debate, a show for the politically eclectic. I'm Robbie Gupta.
And I'm Ricky Schlott.
Well, Ricky, did you notice a difference in how I opened this episode?
Speaking of the politically eclectic, we got a voicemail from Australia recently asking for some clarification from you.
Hi there, calling from Australia. Wanting to know if at the beginning of the episode you say this is a lost debate for political eclectics or for politically eclectics. The OCD part of my brain isn't sure which one you're saying and which one is correct. I think it's politically eclectic, unless I'm wrong. Thanks for the show and apologies for this useless question. Bye for now.
Well, Lost Debate is worldwide. It makes me really excited. It also reminds me that we're going remote even longer than we had anticipated. So I'm trying to figure out where to spend the month of February. So this listener, or any listeners, if you have any ideas of where I should go, I want to keep it within this time zone, although Australia may be far enough that it kind of rewinds.
It'd be like nighttime that night?
I just stay up all night, go to sleep during the day. But he raises an interesting question, and what he means by this, I've been saying Lost Debate is show for political eclectics. And I think what that means is you are an eclectic who happens to be political, whereas if you're politically eclectic, your politics. Well, eclectic could just be like, hey, I have varied interests. You know, I'm a mountain climber and a novelist or something.
Okay.
But if you're politically eclectic, your eclecticness is coming from your politics, and that's who we're speaking to. You can also be a mountain climber who likes to write novels, but we're particularly interested in your eclectic politics.
Okay.
At Lost.
So I've been listening to this for almost a year and thought it meant something entirely different. Like, I thought it meant that we were talking to like an eclectic group of politically interested people. So like, you could be this variety or that, and your viewpoint might be somehow represented at the table.
No, that's what I mean.
Okay.
But that's I think politically eclectic is what you're talking about. Political eclectics.
I'm still confused.
Well, I'm glad I've added to the confusion, but I want to thank this listener for the call. And if anybody who's listening has a better explanation than I had, if you're any grammar nerds out there, English teachers, feel free to send in a voicemail. A few announcements on the front end. We have a Citizen Stewart show this week. We dive deeper into the special education stories we talked about last week, and there's actually more reporting out of the state of Washington with some even more hellacious stuff happening out there. So we talk about that. We talk about an AARP for parents, and I dust off my single people are getting screwed take and really go at it with Chris, who's a parent, on that. We are also Lost Debate as a show are up for the Signal Award, so get out there and vote in the show notes. We'll share a link, and you could vote for us for the People's Choice Award there. And while you're at it, go follow us on Instagram and at Lost Debate.
And one more call for input from you guys is that we're doing a best of show for the holidays. And so give us a call at our voicemail, 321-200-0570. If you have any segments that you love or memorable moments from the show so far.
Great. Well, on a rundown of the show today, we've got a controversial new move to involuntarily hospitalize the mentally ill. Then our very own Joe G will join us to discuss his quest to attain the hottest new job opening in urban government. But we start with a major announcement from the Supreme Court last week.
President Biden's plan for student debt relief is facing a new setback.
Another setback for President Biden's plan to cancel $400 billion in student loan debt.
The administration is promising to fight back against this latest legal setback.
Another setback.
Another legal setback.
Dealt another setback.
A new setback. So what does this mean for the millions of people hoping at least some of their debt would be canceled?
Well, Ricky, this could affect up to 26 million borrowers and $400 billion in student loan relief. And this came as a decision on Thursday from the Supreme Court. And they announced that they're going to fast track review of this case, which was coming out of the Eighth Circuit. And so this case has been going back and forth. There was an initial district court case that actually ruled in favor of the Biden administration. Then it went to the Circuit Court of Appeals, which went the other way and blocked not just the program within the states that were challenging it, but across the entire country. And the background here is that there's a coalition of six GOP-led states, Nebraska, Missouri, Arkansas, Iowa, Kansas, and South Carolina, that challenged the Biden administration's debt relief program on a number of fronts that we'll talk about. And not only has the court said it's going to take this on, but it's leaving in place the injunction that the Eighth Circuit put in place. And, you know, just to translate that for our audience, that means that anybody applying for relief can't get it right now until the Supreme Court rules. So this whole thing is frozen in place. So this is a humongous deal for people who were seeking that relief. Mm-hmm. It's a huge deal for the Biden administration. This was one of their big campaign promises, and I think one of the biggest pieces of progress that they ran on in this midterm election, to the extent they were running on anything. Huge deal.
Yeah. And so when this first was announced, we talked about the kind of logistics of the bill at a whole scale sort of lens, but we left out the likelihood that it actually happens or actually would happen and roll out and be put in place. And I think this is something that pretty much everyone expected to be held up in court to a certain degree, but there are a variety of different legal issues potentially with the way that we're rolling out this relief plan, including, I think, the two biggest ones are whether Biden overstepped his use of executive authority and also whether states are being deprived of tax revenue. There's questions around whether using the HERO Act as a means to implement this was appropriate, whether Congress should have had oversight over this because they are supposed to control our money that we spend, and also now Supreme Court precedents that came out recently that would question whether such a significant issue could be decided just by executive authority. So what would you say are the strongest legal arguments that these states are bringing up against this bill?
It seems fairly strong case, and I don't think the media is doing enough justice to this. Obviously, you know, you heard our montage on the top of the show that people are covering this, but I don't think they're covering how serious this challenge is to the Biden administration. And my sense is the Biden administration wants to just get caught trying. I think the politics of this are good for them, whether they win or lose this case, just because they've tried. And they'll be able to run, if they run again, saying, hey, you know what I tried for you? It was that Supreme Court. I think it's inevitable they're going to run against the Supreme Court as a political entity in the next election. This will just be another layer to that discussion.
Yeah, I don't know, but I think there's also like a cynical element to it too, of like, oh, we just did it for the optics, because you can go back in time and hear Nancy Pelosi saying, well, the president doesn't have the executive authority to do something like this.
People think that the president of the United States has the power for debt forgiveness. He does not. He can postpone, he can delay, but he does not have that power. That has to be an act of Congress.
So if you did know that, is just trying really, like, is it just trying out of good faith? Is it just trying to get the good press and have people say, oh, they're fighting for us, even if this was really inevitably going to be held up in court or just completely not happen in the end?
In their defense, it is untested right now, what they're doing. And I think under a different Supreme Court, it absolutely would have stood. But I think, you know, we're now training, you know, future Supreme Court litigators here on The Lost Debate, our listeners, and they would, you know, longtime listeners will know we talked about this case, West Virginia versus the EPA, which talks about this thing called the major questions doctrine. We will link that episode in the show notes, but it's super technical. But essentially, this was a case that signaled that the Supreme Court is way more skeptical of when the White House and the agencies that are an extension of the White House, like the EPA, but in this case, it's the Department of Education, when they make major moves, what they call vast economic and political significance, so decisions with vast economic and political significance, which this would be one of them for sure, if they make those moves without guidance from Congress, the Supreme Court is very skeptical. Now, without guidance from Congress is the big question here. And this is why I would put this as a 50-50 issue. You talked about the HEROES Act. This is a 2003 law, which was passed in the wake of 9/11, which essentially said in an emergency, there's a whole bunch of stuff within there, but it authorizes the education secretary to waive regulations on student loans during war and national emergency. And so there is a statute, just like with the EPA case, when we talked about that, there was statutory language that gave authority to the cabinet to do certain things. The question is, can they be, can this general language be taken advantage of to ram through pretty extensive changes? In the APA case, I thought it was enough language to justify this. This one, I'm not as sure, because Biden himself went on 60 Minutes and declared the pandemic over, and he's using pandemic authority here, even though there is technically still an emergency order in place, which started in March of 2020 under Trump and now is still technically in place. The Supreme Court has been extremely skeptical of the Biden administration using that emergency authority to take pretty dramatic action. The eviction moratorium is an example of this. The worker vaccine mandate was an example of this. And so the states in their lawsuit accused the Biden administration of using COVID as a pretext to mask a campaign promise or to fulfill a campaign promise. They are absolutely right about that. Whether you like the student loans or not, this has nothing to do with the pandemic and everything to do with a structural argument about student loans. When Biden gives a speech about this, he's not talking about the pandemic anymore. He's talking about just the entire higher education industry and the student loan industry.
Yeah, certainly in the short term during the pandemic, I think the use of the HEROES Act would have been much more justified in the pause sense, because there is an active financial harm being done to people on account of the fact that there are forcible lockdowns and policies that were keeping them from like earning their livelihood and going about their lives. And so I think in the short term that makes sense. But then you look at the fact that this could cost as much as $519 billion over 10 years, and Congress was not involved in that sort of decision. And I think that you end up in far murkier territory. But one of the major arguments is this, that the line of argument that this bill is depriving states of tax revenue.
Yeah, there are two tricky parts of the tax revenue argument. The one that I think is the most interesting, and given that, you know, we are training these future legal scholars on this podcast, is there's this question of the merits of a case versus standing in a case. So when you talk about standing versus merits, standing, and I'll give you a metaphor, right? Like, let's say you walk down the street, you see, you know, God forbid, somebody get hit by a car, but you are not with, you're not the person hit, right? There is a legally remediable thing that happened. Somebody got hit, somebody could sue the person who hit them, right? But you as a bystander to that don't have standing, meaning you did not suffer an injury that you could take to court, even though there is merit to somebody's claim out there. That's what the Supreme Court and other courts decide, which is if you're bringing a case, you have to be the person who is either injured or could potentially be injured in the future. And that is at the heart of this case. A lot of the cases that got dismissed, including this very case when it was in St. Louis, the district court, was dismissed because the federal court said, hey, these states that are bringing this case are not the people taking out these loans. They're not the people who are suffering injury. And longstanding Supreme Court precedence shows that just being a taxpayer is not enough. But what makes this a very fascinating case, and what I think most articles writing about this kind of skipped or skimmed through, is that in Missouri, they actually have an entity that was authorized by the state that the governor and other political actors place the leadership. They like basically point the board, which is like a quasi-public private entity that services student loans, that then directs part of that revenue to the state for higher education. And so when the appeals court went back over this and said, you know what, they do have standing, they said that that revenue that would otherwise go to the state of Missouri is the standing. And there's a whole other complicated thing where if one party has standing, the rest of them do. So if that one state has standing, the rest of them have standing. We don't need to go into that today. So that's one argument on the revenue front. There's another part of the revenue front, which is there's another law passed, which basically created a window for which the student loan relief that's happening here, for a period of time, a few years, the federal government will not tax the student loan relief. So like, let's say you have, you know, $20,000 of student loan debt relieved. You should technically pay taxes on that, but the federal government, through a law recently, decided that they're not going to tax that. And there's like a trickle-down effect to the states where they're arguing that this eventually leads to revenue that they otherwise would take. I think that's a more complicated argument. I don't think they need that argument.
So for the 26 million Americans who have borrowed student loans and who are presumably younger people trying to build their financial futures, especially post-pandemic and reconstruct, and who are 16 million, which of whom have been approved for loan forgiveness, how should they be looking at this unfolding? Should they be planning their lives with the expectation of forgiveness, or should they be planning for the worst case scenario here?
Yeah, I'll give a legal point here and then a practical point. The legal point is that my sense, I'm convinced that the Biden administration knows they're in trouble here. There was a good article by Ilya Soman in Reason. And in that article, there's a couple of things of note. One is that the Biden administration, I did not know this, exempted loans held by private lenders, which there's about 770,000. And in that article, they argue that this is because the Biden administration wanted to make it more difficult to get standing from the private players because they felt like the most likely people to bring a suit against the Biden administration were private players. Now, they knew they couldn't go after entities like this Missouri entity because that would have been everybody else. Mm-hmm. It's a whole longer story. But the reason why I bring this up is because this is evidence that the Biden administration knew they had a weak case on the merits because otherwise they wouldn't be worried about standing, right? If there's, like, to use my metaphor, if there's no car accident and there's no, or it's just a total accident, like no fault car accident, you're not worried about standing because nobody can bring a suit. But in this case, they seemed concerned in the beginning. So I, if I'm reading the tea leaves, I'm saying there's a legal issue here where the Biden administration seems to be signaling privately that they have an issue. The problem I have with the Biden administration, though, is that the education sector secretary and others who are making public pronouncements are, you know, signaling, oh, we're confident. The education secretary said we believe strongly that the lawsuits are meritless and the Department of Justice has appealed on our behalf. And he says, your application is complete and approved and we will discharge your approved debt if and when we prevail in court. Now, I think they're being too optimistic to people. I think people should plan for a loss here, even though I think it's 50-50. But there's not much people could do because right now the Biden administration extended the student loan pause until 60 days after the student loan forgiveness litigation is fully resolved or 60 days after June 30th, 2023. So they have some time here to make decisions. But I would not plan your life based on a certainty that your student loans are going to be wiped out.
Yeah, I mean, looking at this from the outside, it feels to me like a really frustrating demonstration of just looking to get political points, especially since the writing has been on the wall that at the very least, this would have been held up considerably for a long time in many different courts, both in the local level and in the Supreme Court level, knowing who is on the Supreme Court at the moment. And so I just like watching people who don't have the time and the luxury of going through Supreme Court cases and or a law degree to figure out what the heck is actually going on. Like, it feels very frustrating to me. And it reminds me of growing up and we'd have a student body election every year and they would be saying, oh, we're going to get a vending machine and we're going to put it in the outside of the cafeteria or in all the hallways. And every single presidential candidate would promise the vending machine, knowing that that is not a thing that could ever happen. And the year before, the same president tried to say the same thing. And I feel like it felt like a false promise to me, where this could actually be a really powerful area for reform for Congress to come together. I think there's room for bipartisan reform here because everybody's concerned about the state of higher education, whether it's the debt that people are finding them in, the quality of education that's being delivered to people. I mean, everybody knows somebody with student loans who's crippled by a system that's being enriched by federally backed loans that people can't default on. There's so much room to actually reform the system going forward. And this, like, vote for me because I'll pause your misery but not actually fix things for future generations of students stuff is just not satisfying to me.
Yeah, I think what the Biden administration would say back to that is, look, if we have this is just my very informal calculation, 50% chance of prevailing in court on this. So we have a 50% chance.
Why is there not long-term reform? Like, that's my problem.
What they would say is because you can't get anything passed in Congress to get through a filibuster. And I think they're kind of right on that. And
I think that long-term reform on the way that we dole out loans is something that has pretty broad-based support, especially among conservatives who are concerned about the quality of higher education or concerned about the fact that trade schools are falling by the wayside and people are being like basically socially compelled to get degrees that are not required to live life or to do the jobs that they're ultimately going to do. I think there's actually, especially with all the anti-higher education sentiment on the right now, a way to at least do some sort of reform. And I haven't really seen that tried. I've just seen this all or nothing approach that's really frustrating.
Yeah, I'm with you. And you know, we did a whole thing about how we would rather, like, how we would craft this differently. Yeah. And we'll link to both. We wrote something on our website, but also we did a whole discussion of it multiple times, I think, where we've talked about different ways to structure this so that it gets at the jobs that we really want. I agree. I think that the political problem here and why we see so many executive orders like this or cabinet actions is because it's so hard to get anything done. And so, you know, my hope is that people wake up and that people start to make progress on all these issues, which don't need to be that political. Like, I think you can reform higher education without it being
partisan.
It
could be a much more nuanced conversation than just forgiving X amount of dollars. It could be an actual conversation about what's wrong with the system and how we ended up in this place in the first place. And I've heard none of that. I've just heard talking past each other, one side and the other, and very little nuance coming from lawmakers on this issue.
Well, I will just put a couple things on the calendar for our listeners. In February, there will be oral arguments in this. You usually get a sense of where the justices are going to go based on those oral arguments. And then decisions from the Supreme Court are generally handed down in June, which is why the timeline that the Biden administration, when they say no later than June or 3 months or whatever, 30 days after June, the reason why everything's pegged to June is this is when you typically hear from the Supreme Court. So we will find out relatively soon the status of this program.
Well, as we move on to our latter two stories, I think fair warning that we get a little New York heavy here, but I think particularly this first question about homelessness and how we can handle it is something with national implications. But just last Tuesday, Eric Adams announced a new directive that is pretty consequential in how the city will handle homeless people, and particularly homeless people that are visibly mentally ill. He is now allowing involuntary transport of the mentally ill by the NYPD, FDNY, and DOH for anyone that, quote, appears to be mentally ill and displays an inability to meet basic living needs, even when no recent dangerous act has been observed. And so this is an important difference in policy action. There's no actual new law here, but the nuance is that usually, or in the past it had been, if someone is dangerous or poses a danger, then they could be involuntarily taken in to someone else, or potentially like to themselves if they're going to jump in front of a subway car. But this is now, if you can't take care of yourself, if you're clearly decrepit and your basic standards of living are so visibly curtailed by your mental illness, then this is the new threshold that is much lower that a larger swath of city officials can take. So let's hear Eric Adams describe this new initiative.
The man standing all day on the street across from the building he was evicted from 25 years ago, waiting to be let in. The shadow boxer on the street corner in Midtown, mumbling to himself as he jabs at an invisible adversary. The unresponsive man unable to get off the train at the end of the line without his assistance from our mobile crisis team. These New Yorkers and hundreds of others like them are in urgent need of treatment, yet often refuse it when offered.
Well, Ricky, I think this is such an important question, because whenever you take away somebody's liberty without any due process, which is essentially what we're talking about here, we need to bring the uttermost scrutiny to these decisions.
Totally.
And of course, there's a long history in this country of involuntary civil commitment. And, you know, you could deprive somebody of their liberty for the rest of their life without a criminal trial in certain cases. But we're generally very careful about how we do that. And what worries me here, even as somebody who doesn't love seeing people on the street jabbing at the air or standing in front of a building, you know, that they lived in 25 years ago, what he described here. In this speech, he's laying out examples that don't seem to be a threat to either the person or other people. So if somebody's standing in front of a building that they lived in 25 years ago, they're not harming themselves or somebody else. One could make an argument that somebody jabbing the air is dangerous to other people, but he specifically said jabbing an invisible person, right? Obviously, if he's starting to jab at actual human beings, it would fall under an old standard of threat to other people, right? So like, I'm not sure I love the examples he's given here. It makes me worried that we may be overstepping.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that I struggle with a lot personally, especially like as someone with libertarian tendencies, but also someone who lives in New York, and every single day on my way to work, I see people who are like visibly so decrepit and so beyond any ability to take care of themselves that I don't think the like true libertarian principle of just live and let live is really applying there. Like it's so tragic to see the state of some people here, particularly in the winter, particularly when we just walk right past them, as he says, without any regard for their humanity, because there's really nothing else that we can do. And I just don't think that the most humane thing is allowing that to continue because they have a civil liberty to be miserable and on the streets and beyond help. And, you know, I've seen people go through mental health treatment, and one of the large portions of getting yourself to that place to get better is that oftentimes family members who love you will say, like, you need to get help. Like, I don't really care if you think that you need to get help, because you're not in the mindset to make that decision for yourself. And these are obviously people without a family structure to lean on. And so I think, yes, I'm absolutely suspicious of the vagueness of this bill, but I do think, or of this new provision, I think it's well-meaning. I think it needs to be very, very deliberate in what sort of instances would constitute this. But I do think that there is a visible and obvious need when you see people that are just so beyond any means to take care of themselves and beyond the mental awareness to be able to really consent to something.
Well, just to add some details to this, just to put some color on this, the new city directive on the policy acknowledges, quote, that case law does not provide extensive guidance regarding removals for mental health evaluations based on short interactions in the field. And the city directive states, quote, unawareness or delusional misapprehension of surroundings or delusional misapprehension of physical conditions or health could be grounds for hospitalizations. I think a big question people are asking here is there enough training? Is there enough awareness here? One thing I do like about this is that there's a commitment, and I want to put a caveat on this because it's New York, we're not very good at implementing things. There is a commitment to add some kind of teleservice to have the first responders on the ground communicate with people who are mental health specialists to help make evaluations in the field. I want to put a big asterisk on that because people promise a lot in the city and don't deliver.
Yeah, I think that should be a contingency for this to go through. But then there's also additional training that will be required for officers. And when they do commit somebody somewhere, they need to fill out an aided report. So I think that's clearly very important for accountability and making sure that the right people are actually ending up in forced treatment. But I mean, there's a lot of questions that remain to be answered. I would have liked, if Eric Adams had asked for my advice, I'd say have as many answers to these questions as possible. But I mean, even on my way here, I was listening to Reason's podcast, which is a publication of libertarians that are certainly some of whom are more libertarian than me. And like the general consensus of them, including Nick Gillespie, who lives in New York, who I would say is very stringently libertarian, was like, yeah, I'm not seeing any other solutions for this. And there's clearly no application of, like, it's my civil liberty to be absolutely like in a decrepit state. And I think if it's very carefully applied, I don't see any other solution except for the fact that this is a really inconvenient and tragic thing to have to do, but I don't know what else to do.
But what I would say to Nick in return is we have to draw the line very clearly. And agreed. What Eric Adams is laying out is like, I have a right to not be physically assaulted. I don't have a right to just be comfortable in every settings with the way everybody looks, right? Or like if somebody's standing outside of a building, like the first example Eric Adams gave in that speech.
Yeah, I would say that's not
was an absurd example, right? Like, yeah. I don't have a right.
I think his point is like, if somebody is like so mentally out of touch with reality that that's how they're spending their life, and a simple medication or a psych evaluation could help them actually get their 25 years of their life on a different path, that would be helpful. But that's certainly not the best number one answer to go to. I mean, you see people who are living on subway cars, who are in their own filth, who it's like you can't look at that and say like, oh, they're expressing their rights. Like, they're not even aware of where they are and what's going on, and just allowing that to continue without some sort of like humane intervention is to me not the right move either. And I'm seeing people say this is dystopian, this could be abused, and I agree with that, but I'm not seeing this is what we should do instead.
Yeah, but I do think that sometimes you can tailor the law. Like the example of the person on a subway car, you could just write a law or regulation, which probably exists right now against, I forget what the word is, but vagrancy or something, like being on the subway car at the end of the stop. If you don't get off that subway, that is, you're breaking the law versus like what you're wearing or whether you're talking to yourself or whatever. But
yeah, so then just go do the same thing outside in the cold, like open to the elements. Like,
but
just
the thing is, I don't want to force people, right? Like, I don't want to force people indoors. And the other thing is, like, we've got to actually, like, in order to actually solve the problem too, there's a certain critical infrastructure that may be missing here. And there was the founder of Pathways to Housing, Samson Baris, had something to say on this front. Let's go to him.
And another well-intentioned mayor almost 35 years ago in New York City by the name of Ed Koch had an exactly the same proposal to take people who were apparently a danger to themselves or gravely disabled off the streets involuntarily, bring them to the hospital for treatment. And this was an idea of a compassionate approach, as Mayor Adams just said, a moral obligation to do something about homelessness. Yes, we do have a moral obligation to do something about homelessness, but that something has to be informed by evidence and experience. We already know that involuntary treatment in a psychiatric hospital is not a solution to homelessness. Housing is a solution to homelessness, and follow-up mental health support services are what helps people with mental illness do better.
So what I hear here, though, is like, I'm not trying to solve homelessness as an issue with this one measure. I think what Eric Adams is trying to do is like help people who are clearly so far beyond what like a temporary shelter could do for them, or what like a minor intervention can do for them. And also, we know that we have a systemic housing issue here. We also know that in terms of like, yes, supportive housing would be the best, most ideal situation, and you'd want every single person to have dedicated staff to take care of them. But like, that's just not the reality. And allowing people to continue to live the way that they very visibly and often are living on the streets of New York because we don't have this perfect like supportive housing solution for them is also like, yeah, that's ideal, but that's, I don't see the plan to make that happen. I don't. And there's a year-long wait list right now for getting into the outpatient supportive care that he's talking about. Like, what do we do about people right now?
Yeah, and I agree with that there's an urgent question right now. And I think this dovetails with certain things that we've talked about previously on this podcast, including the very question of why it's so hard to build housing in New York City. And this is not Eric Adams's fault, but it's his responsibility in terms of like the state of New York public infrastructure right now. But again, it is his responsibility and other leaders to tackle the problem of why it's so damn expensive to build critical infrastructure in the city. And it goes beyond housing for the homeless. It goes beyond housing for the mentally ill. When he made this speech, he touted that the governor has committed to help fund and create 50 psychiatric beds in New York City. This is a city of 10 million plus people. This is a laughable amount of beds to throw at this problem. And when you go rundown of New York, we talked last week about the $1 billion that's being misspent in many ways, or questionably spent every year on private schools for the wealthy. We've talked to Brian Rosenthal previously on this podcast, a New York Times writer, Pulitzer Prize winning writer, who talked about how New York is spending $2.5 billion per mile to build subway tracks. Like, many, many times more than any other city in the world. And we talk about like the fact that we're spending over $500,000 per inmate per year. We're spending $4.2 billion on NYCHA, which had 582,000 maintenance requests of January, most of which are not being fulfilled in a quick and humane manner. You just go down the list and say everything costs so much, in part because we have politicians who generally sell out to either public service unions or contractors, or just like to make bold promises without trying to scrutinize how dollars are spent. And when I talked to Brian Rosenthal about this from the Times, he was like, I'm not a small government person. I actually want government to solve people's problems, and our inability to get costs under control in place X means that in place Y, in this case, the people who need mental health treatment, we don't get them the beds that they need. We don't get them the treatment that they need, you know?
Yeah, but I think like with this specific provision here, the question is not about like government spending, because you can build a ton of housing units for people. This is about like, you can't throw any amount of money at people or in this situation to make people agree to get the treatment that they clearly need. Like, that's the fundamental issue here. It's not about the people who want shelter or who want help or who want housing. It's about like, what do you do about the groups of people who are in such a state that's so removed from reality that they don't even have the ability to potentially consent to something, and they're living in public property and they're basically under the watchful eye of the state, which, I mean, of course we don't want that, but like, what does the state do when they're out there in public property, when they're on the subway stations, when they are so far beyond the point that they can consent? I don't think that money solves that problem. I think, you know, at the very least, mandating that a judge needs to get in front of like each case to say, yes, this person should be committed or they shouldn't. Like there's in Washington, there's a provision that's similar to that. Or I mean, just having a psych eval on them as a starting point potentially to see, like, rather than just locking people up forever or putting them in some hellish psychiatric ward. Like no money will solve the fact that there are people who clearly need help in New York City and cities around the country who are so beyond the point that they can ask for it themselves. And what do we do about that? Like that's the impossible moral question. And Eric Adams isn't in a palatable position to have to make a choice on that. But he would be well advised to say, here are the exact circumstances. Or right now we're just going to hospitalize people who look like they very clearly could be a threat to other people. Or I don't know.
It's a difficult question. I think it gets really down to the Constitution, right? We have the due process clause. You can't deprive people of due process, life, liberty, or property without due process of law. So what you're saying around a judge being involved is really important. Somebody,
there needs to be some sort of standard.
Yeah, with some kind of appeals process, some kind of standard. Now I know you can't do that immediately, but in my opinion, it has to be part of the process pretty quickly. And the speedy trial provisions should apply here, even though it's generally meant for a criminal trial. Like there should be a fast process where people are, looking into the evidence here. And Norman Siegel from the New York ACLU put it, I think, pretty well. He said, just because someone smells, because they haven't had a shower for weeks, because they're mumbling, because their clothes are disheveled, that doesn't mean they're a danger to themselves or others. He says, and they're going to have the cops of all people make those decisions. He was asking that question, right? So
yeah, I just still, here. I look at that example though, and I'm like, yeah, it doesn't mean that they're like an active danger to themselves, but they're not even themselves at that point in time. Like I've seen people who've gotten treatment for mental illness come out of it and like come out of an experience where they don't want help or they're denying everyone that's trying to reach out to them. And they're so glad that they did once they did. And so it's hard for me to say, to like look at somebody and say, oh, they're disheveled and talking to themselves and covered in piss and smell bad because they want to be or because that's their prerogative. Like it's very clearly not, and it's a horrible situation. And I think that, I don't 100% agree with how Eric Adams is going about this without the clarification on the very specific instances in which this would be appropriate. But I think that he's right that there needs to be something done.
Yeah, there's also a fine line here and slippery slope when it comes to other health issues, right? Because people are dangerous to them, their own health in many ways. Like we have an obesity crisis in America, we have a diabetes crisis, we have a cardiovascular health crisis in America, and people actively make decisions that are against their own interests, their own long-term interests. In certain cases, people get so morbidly obese that they are immobile. And the question is, are we going to then involuntarily commit those people because they're a danger to themselves? And when would you make that decision, right? Like in certain cases, like obviously if somebody is on the brink of death, then certain emergency medical provisions come into play. But we draw those lines in a very clear place for a reason, because we are a country that is founded on this ideal of a certain kind of freedom, right? But so like, what do other people do? Because we talk about money, right? We've done a whole bunch, and we'll link to in the show notes, the homelessness stories that we've done. Particularly, we talked about places like Salt Lake City, and we juxtaposed it with San Francisco, which I agree money doesn't solve everything. But in certain cases, like there is an infrastructure that needs to be in place. There need to be people paid to counsel people. There need to be beds. There needs to be a warm place to send that person that's not a prison. And there needs to be money put into a legal system to arbitrate the due process issues. All of that needs to be in place. No one part of that solves it, but it does seem like we need some version of all of those things. Is there any place where you feel like gets this right?
There's a bunch of different versions. Like there are many states that allow involuntary outpatient treatment, so you're not being committed to a hospital, and police and medical workers can dole that out. Governor Newsom just in September signed a law that's very similar to the one that we have here, which would have involuntary treatment for people who are experiencing schizophrenia and related mental disorders that are homeless, but we're yet to really see what that looks like on the ground. And then in Washington, you're able to be committed to a hospital, but a judge must find that you're a threat to yourself or others. Mm-hmm. And so I think that being the threshold, like it's not perfect and it's never going to be perfect. And this is one of those really sticky issues that like no matter what you do, you're never going to do it flawlessly, but at least having some sort of judge provision or at the very least, which I think New York City is very much lacking, an accountability provision that like you don't want one cop who's super gung-ho to be just applying this willy-nilly to people that are irritating to them or based on some sort of life experience. And so I think the best sort of situation would be just to have as many checks and balances in place to make sure that this is only being applied in the most severe instances.
Yeah, there's like two kinds of abuses I'm worried about. There's the individual abuse, but then I think there's like the systemic abuse, right? Which, and what I mean by that is, and this is particularly an issue in dense places, right? You don't hear these debates as much in places where people are spread out, because a lot of the things that people are complaining about in New York City have to do with the subway and certain confined spaces. And that's also where a lot of the violence is occurring right now. And so it dovetails with that. And we're mixing those issues in many ways. But I think I also worry about systemic abuse in the sense that here's this undesirable population, and we're going to try to use these types of provisions. I'm not saying this is what's happening right now, but it's a step in that direction to say we're going to use this law to drive those people out of our city. That's where I think we should be careful, is to say, all right, like, we have every right to say we want or don't want certain people in our city as voting, you know, members of the public, and politicians can make whatever argument they want. But where I draw the line is to deprive people of their due process in service of that aim. That, I think, crosses a line that we need to be careful of.
Yeah, I mean, at the very least, cynically, the fact that we have such a meager infrastructure to actually house these people will prevent that in the short term. But I think, I mean, I certainly don't think that's Eric Adams' motivation here. And just making it very clear where this can and cannot be applied would be helpful to kind of avoid some of the slippery slope arguments. Okay, so now let's move on to an interesting new local position, a job posting that is available. Eric Adams' office has just announced that there is a new rat czar position for all of those who might be rodent inclined. And this is coming on the back of the fact that we are now the second rattiest city in the country behind Chicago. There are rumored to be as many as 8 million rats here. There was one actual study from 2014 that said 2 million, but it's up there. It's a lot. It's potentially as many as there are humans here. And just last year, there were 21,600 complaints about rats. And so Adams, as a result, is calling for someone with a virulent vehemence for vermin, with drive, determination, and killer instinct needed to fight the real enemy, who can burrow into the depths of the city government and be the leader of the rat pack.
Well, that sounds like somebody I know, Ricky.
Does it?
Well, that person, it's obviously Joe Garvey, longtime listener to the podcast.
It does not sound like someone I know named Joe
Garvey.
So
we're welcoming Joe. If you're new to the podcast, Joe is a reporter researcher here with the Lost Debate team. Joe, welcome to the pod.
Thank you very much for having me, guys.
So, Joe, what we're going to do, because we no longer need your services here, we need to help find you a new job. This is a really well-paying job. I think it's like $150,000 to $170,000.
$120,000 to $170,000. It's a nice bracket there.
Equinox All Access, here I come.
Well, I used to share an office with a young man named Christopher Marte, who is now the city council member for New York City District 1, the very district that we're in right now, which also happens to have a ton of rats, I could tell you from personal experience. So we're going to welcome Chris on this pod. And Joe, you're going to pitch him on you as the rats are.
Oh, I'm ready to go.
All right, Christopher Marte, welcome to the podcast. Councilman Christopher Marte, I'm sorry.
Thank you for having me, y'all. I'm excited about this.
I should mention, just so we stay above board here, that you do know Joe. We actually met him on the same day together when we were training him up for a campaign back in the day. So I just want to make sure that other applicants, we disclose all of this. It could be a conflict of interest.
Yeah, I personally am a little nervous about applying, but thank you, Chris, for joining. I frankly think the 8 million is an undercount, just based on how many rats are in my apartment.
I thought it was going to be a lot more than 8. Like, it seems like there should be more than one for every person, considering how many little crevices there are in the city for them to populate. Like, I actually was like, that sounds less than
I
thought.
It's 100% an undercount.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, so Chris, if it's okay with you, I'm just going to read you my cover letter, which I wrote directed to you.
Go for it.
So, dear Chris, please accept this letter and accompanying resume and application for the position of Rat Czar. To demonstrate my confidence in fulfilling the duties of Rat Czar, I present you with 3 guaranteed solutions to eliminate the city's rat population. Solution 1, rat bounties, $1 for every rat you personally exterminate.
Oh, I like that. Mm.
You know, you can't even get a slice of pizza for $1, so I don't know who's going to do this. I think we need a I know we're in an inflationary period, so you got to make it a little bit more than that. Mm. Yeah.
Chris, you and I both know the way the city spends money, it'll have no problem.
Well, Chris is a Democrat. Yeah, they'll find money.
Right, yeah, come on.
We'll keep taxing the same billionaires that we keep paying for all programs, and it's hypothetical tax.
Exactly. All right, solution number 2. incorporate rats into our cuisine, which many countries already do. And we've humans have a history of eating animals into extinction.
Chris, what do you think about that? You have some of the finest restaurants in all of New York City in your district. Do you think you can convince any of them to do this?
You know, I think it's an interesting concept, and I think we should experiment. You know, they say that you can look at the genetics of a rat and know which neighborhood it looks in. And I wonder if that qualifies for taste, right? Would a Lower East Side rat taste much better than a, you know, Upper West Side, Upper East Side? So I think that's something we can investigate. I like this. I like where it's going.
And Chris, informally, I'd love just a little breakdown of how you see the rats in your district, because I told the story on the pod a little while ago. I was over the summer having dinner at La Conda Verde, which is in your district down in Tribeca. And I would say the rats in Tribeca are some of the fattest rats I think I've seen in the district. And this was almost like a cat-like size to it. Like, do you have any sense of, like, you talk about the different personalities, like, how do you know a Lower East Side rat versus a Nolita rat and a Soho rat or a Tribeca rat?
I think it's about how aggressive they are. You know, in the Lower East Side, they're like, hey, watch how I'm walking here, you know? A little bit more, you know, staying to their step. And what I tell people every day is, like, you're only seeing the rats that are on the street. What about the ones that aren't? The ones you can't see, the one between the walls, underneath your bed at night.
That's a great and thought.
So, underneath the outdoor dining huts those that we've constructed, they're nests. It's disgusting.
It's crazy.
Yeah. I hear them behind my bed.
Well, okay, give us your third. Give us your third.
Okay, this one is, I think, the most practical. It's herd the rats using peanut butter to the Staten Island Ferry and then shutter them on the island.
On Staten Island?
Yes.
Chris, careful how you respond to this one, because I know you have citywide ambitions.
I would never do this to Ravi's mom, who's a native, a resident of Staten Island, and because I cherish her and she's been feels like a long lifelong friend.
Tell the truth.
I could never do this to her, and I'm scared of her too. Maybe we send it to New Jersey. You might be able to get my support for it, but not to Staten Island.
But Chris,
my dad's there. Can't do that to him either.
Well, Chris, you and I used to sit down with Eric Adams pretty regularly before he ran for mayor. And if you remember, you remember when he did the rat trap thing and we were talking about, we were sitting around the office and we were trying to like figure out, all right, who handicapping the race. I remember, tell me if I'm wrong about this, but during the rat trap where he came up with this rat trap to drown rats and people were making fun of him. I distinctly remember us saying, wow, this guy actually may win.
I remember that fairly clearly. I almost can't forget the sound of the voice of the rats dying during those segments. And so that one's going to stay with me for a really long time.
Too many Eric Adams stories to tell on this podcast. But
well, right before we recorded this, Kate showed me a video of Joe when they found like a mouse here, not even a rat, I don't think.
Yeah, so
and there are like five of you that are looking for this mouse. And the only person who ends up standing on top of a counter is you.
Where is he?
I lost him.
He went
through my legs.
He went through his legs.
Why did you jump up? What's wrong with you?
I admit that's true.
I'm sure that you're the rats.
If you're afraid
are,
of mice, you should not be in New York
City.
Yeah, because the mice are just there. And Chris knows I live now in an apartment in the same building that we used to have our office. And the mice were everywhere there. And they still, I deal with them.
But it's the fear that's driving my motivation to get rid of these things.
But you're
you
going
need
to.
The fear. The
I don't,
right
Chris, I don't know. If we're thinking about the job, sorry, Joe, as much as I want to get you out of this office. I don't know if fear is what we need. I think we need an intrepid personality. If you go back to that job description, right?
We're killer instinct.
Yeah, I'm not hearing a killer instinct.
Yeah.
And also
fighting the real enemy.
Chris, you also know this probably about Joe, that he, and our audience definitely knows this, that he's been struggling in the lady department. I'm not sure in your app, if you say I'm the rat czar, that's going to attract a lot of willing suitors.
No, you're probably right. There's no way I'm fit for this position.
Yeah. Chris, can you just confirm, just for the record keeping for the city of New York, that we're just going to move on from Joe here?
Yeah, you know, he could try again next time. Maybe a little bit more life experience. He has to be out there a little bit more.
I think there's just a socialization that's happened. Ricky, you and I have talked about this. I think people are just less afraid of rats. I think it's just something that people have come to deal with who are New Yorkers now. Obviously, the tourists feel differently. I think it's jarring for a lot of people who haven't spent time in the city.
Yeah, I don't know. I think the fault lies with us for just being kind of gross and putting our trash out too early and like not actually, we're missing the trash cans when we're throwing things out
agreed.
And we're not taking care of our city. We don't really treat it with respect by and large. And I'm not going to blame the rodents who found a spot to burrow in. I mean,
this is good political advice for Chris. Next time when you're running, pro-rat, anti-human. Yeah. What do you think of that, Chris?
Got to live to coexist. I'm into it.
Maybe we should allow them to vote too, and then that strategy might work.
Thank you. We'll keep fielding new applicants for you here, but thanks for coming on the pod. Thanks for your leadership in this district. Have a good day and keep fighting the good fight.
Thank you all. And Joe, good luck out there.
Thanks for your consideration, Chris.
Well, thank you to everyone for listening to the show. We were a little bit more New York heavy than we usually want to be, but the issues just fit together today and we couldn't help but bringing Joe back on to talk about that job. Thanks for listening. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Give us that 5-star rating. Like us on YouTube. Follow us on YouTube. And we'll be right back here on Thursday with a whole slate of new stories.
Lost Debate is the flagship show of the Lost Debate Network. Our executive producer is Michael Hendricks. Research support by Joe Garvey and Ariane Misra. Studio support and video editing by Moyo Adeolu. Editing and sound design by Joe Engelbrecht and Monica Espedia.